Oh, thank you, Guy. And talking of lowering the tone, here I am. Okay, two bits of advice I've had already. Speak slowly and speak loudly. Can you hear me at the back? Including my family. Bit louder, wee bit louder. Okay. If it drops down again, maybe people at the back can wave at me. Okay, right. You know that line from Paul in Corinthians? When I became a man, I put away childish things. In 1971, we moved to a country most of the maps were still calling British Guyana. And there was a lizard living in my toy box. I remember the lizard more than the toys, but more than either, I remember a handful of other items in the house. Three, to be precise. But what were these items, these artifacts, these fetishized objects? Not so much childish things as a personal iconography of sorts, a somewhat less than holy trinity. There was a Johnny Cash LP, the cover featuring a photo of the man in black, dressed like a cowboy, on what was meant to look like a torn wanted poster. Johnny Cash sings the ballads of the true West, released by Columbia Records in 1965. The year Guyana gained its independence. There was a Cuvier's dwarf caiman, a crocodilian of the alligator family, stuffed with straw, marbles for eyes, tiny razor teeth, on hind legs, tail curled behind her, morbid and magnificent, a smiling atrocity. And there was a small wooden carving of the wise monkeys. Mizuru, who sees no evil, hand covering his eyes. Mikazuru, who hears no evil, hand covering his ears. Mazuru, who speaks no evil, hand covering his mouth. The three mystic apes. Now, sometimes in the telling of that story, there's a fourth monkey, Sezuru, hands covering his genitals or his nose. He's said to symbolize do no evil. Were it possible to animate that carving, I would ask our wise and mystic friends to help us ponder this question. What question? It was the title of a sermon, later a book, Dr. King gave in Atlanta on the 16th of August 1967, the day I was born, 2 years after Guyana gained independence, and four before a lizard moved into my toy box. It recurs in popular culture, including a sci-fi anthology from the early 70s, and songs by Yoko Ono, Radiohead, and Tupac. This year's Edinburgh International Festival adopted it as a slogan. It appeared on the sides of buses and trams, on the front of programmes and posters, and above the doors of theatres and venues throughout the city. The director of the EIF, centrepiece to the world's biggest cultural festival, was inspired by this question. This question, in a post-pandemic world, in a cost of living crisis, in a climate emergency, in a time of war, it seems simple but profound. The question is, where do we go from here? Nicola Benedetti invited us to consider this question in three ways: community over chaos, hope in the face of adversity, and a perspective not of one's own. She also wanted to deepen our culture of listening. I'd like to talk today about what the helpline Samaritans and others can teach us about listening and about community, hope, and understanding, which sounds like the title of a song. We'll come back to that. But we've already been to 1971, 1965, and 1967. Why don't we jump to 2008? The contrast to drab furniture and children's art on the wall suggests a local council office, or perhaps the least loved corner of a nursery. One of the paintings depicts a family home in front of which is parked a car with a red and blue light. A figure wearing a hat is marching the dad toward that car. Welcome to the main meeting room in Edinburgh's Children's Hearings Office, part of the care and justice system for children and young people in Scotland. Three of us sit one side of the table, three the other. The star of the show is seated between two prison guards. the mother of a little boy who's been looked after elsewhere. When she came in, she was handcuffed. She still is. She says five words. I don't want to leave. Her words are so soft, they could be spoken from the bottom of a well. And you expect that's where her psyche dwells, rather than this formally informal space with a pile of picture books and a plastic fire engine in one corner. I don't want to leave. Where doesn't she want to leave? This room? This city? This country? The colleague to my right leans over and says in my ear, she said she doesn't want to live. Ah. I've heard, but I've not listened. I've not anticipated this. I've not scribbled anything on this piece of paper that helps. The picture blurs. We fast forward again in time. Monday this week, an office in the West End of Scotland's capital, the afternoon shift. The telephone rings, except it doesn't ring. A light on the otherwise standard landline phone pulses with a reddish flash. On the third ring, or flash, I pick it up. I don't say hello, I don't say my name, I don't make a fuss. I say five words, and then I listen. I listen, and I listen, and I listen. I also, I echo words and phrases. I seek to clarify, I summarize, I ask open questions, and I try not to interrupt. Silence is a conversational tool, and this is a conversation, if a particular kind of conversation. Because words matter, right? Words are what connect us. Words are a key component of what make us human. As speechwriters, we intuitively know this. If I may borrow a Dutch idiom, that's a little egg. Is that something you say? Or have I just Googled that? And in words, in dialogue, in that human exchange, we can seek hope. We might not always find it, but can at least look and listen for it. The novelist and art critic John Berger, an English thinker buried in France, he said, hope is not a form of guarantee, it's a form of energy. And very frequently, that energy is strongest in circumstances that are very dark. And so I pick up the phone and I say five words. Samaritans, can I help you? The conversation that follows may be about loneliness, depression, grief, addiction, anxiety, abuse, trauma, suicide, and more. Always more. The more that comes from lived experience, to use that anemic phrase, the more that speaks of the human condition at its most fragile, the more that emerges like a whisper from the bottom of a well. People will share with Samaritans their deepest feelings and their darkest thoughts, the burden they carry, the broken pieces of their hearts, the troubles that could make a country singer blush. According to Eve Meyer, director of the San Francisco Suicide Prevention Center, you try and find out the things stronger than they are, the dream, the belief, whatever pulls them along when their spiritual muscles are giving out. You're hunting for the people or things they love that make life worthwhile. And I'm not betraying any secrets to say I've known conversations touch upon honor among Hell's Angels, the musical preferences of white witches, David Bowie's film career, the words for cat and dog in Hindi, show tunes from South Pacific, and the memory of a stolen kiss outside a coffee house in Soho, circa 1963. It was a speechwriter friend who first told me about the privilege of being a Samaritan and the trust that callers give you in return for the time you give them, the time and the attention. The teacher and activist Simone Weil, a French thinker buried in England, she said, to listen to someone is to put oneself in his place while he is speaking. To put oneself in the place of someone whose soul is corroded by affliction or in near danger of it, is to annihilate oneself. They believed it was only the afflicted who could speak the truth. Of the wisdom of fools, she said, everybody, including Shakespeare's readers and audience for four centuries, is unaware that what they say is true, and not satirically or humorously true, but simply the truth, pure, unadulterated truth, luminous, profound, essential. And she saw solitude as being in the presence of mere matter, the sky, the stars, the moon, trees in blossom. Its value lies in the greater possibility of attention. If we could be attentive to the same degree in the presence of a human being, another leap in time. April this year, a walk on the local promenade, the morning sun in my eyes, and I'm as blind as a badger at the best of times. Two young men stop to say hello. Do I know them? I can walk past members of my family in the street. My daughter even does a little robot dance, so I know that it's her. Hiya. Turns out I don't know them, but too late. We're missionaries, they say. Gulp. We're from Utah, they say. Right. Can you spare a minute, they say. Are you interested in God, they say. Not God per se, I say. And I start to riff on the way the sunlight glints on the waves just so. The simple pleasure of watching a dog chase a ball across the beach. My take on heaven in a wild flower from the William Blake poem. I speak about suicide statistics and the talking cure, and how I can experience the world differently after I finish a Samaritan shift, more vividly, more pungently, more noisily. Like in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy wakes to find herself somewhere over the rainbow, and the film switches from monochrome to technicolor. After 5 minutes of this shtick, my new Mormon friends politely take flight. The novelist and poet Muriel Spark, a Scottish thinker buried in Italy, she said, I think hell is empty and all the devils are here. I suspect the unsuspecting missionaries would agree. But I wonder about their idea of community. Is it only for those who repent their sins and the rest of us be damned? Let me just say, I consider speechwriters to be my tribe. You make words sing, you make sentences dance, you make paragraphs jump over the moon. You're as skilled as poets, but without the prickly egos which can accompany that particular sect. I consider Samaritans to be my tribe. They are, to paraphrase founder Chad Vara, ordinary people doing something extraordinary. Cracking eggs, as my son used to describe people he liked. And I've yet to meet a Sam I couldn't learn something from. I consider the supporters of Celtic Football Club to be my tribe. Founded in Glasgow's East End in 1888, to quote Brother Wilfrid, for the maintenance of dinner tables for the children and unemployed. Belting out Rodgers and Hammerstein's You'll Never Walk Alone with 50,000 other believers before a game, that would be my idea of a church congregation. You could say I belong to many tribes, but don't we all? There is another way of looking at this. In the words of essayist and poet Jorge Luis Borges, an Argentinian thinker buried in Switzerland, in all the world, one man has been born and one man has died. That man is Ulysses, Abel, Cain, the first to make constellations of the stars, to build the first pyramid, the bookseller who fathered Samuel Johnson, Voltaire's gardener, Darwin aboard the Beagle, a Jew in the death chamber, and in time, you and me. And from that sense of you and me, from community, from conversation, from what some call active listening, comes what? Hope, tolerance, empathy, love? I read a recent magazine article by Ali Smith, my favourite current Scottish writer. It was about Simone de Beauvoir's memoir of a dying mother. De Beauvoir was a contemporary of the other Simone. She was slated for that book. Imagine exploiting the death of the woman who gave birth to you. She was unrepentant. She said, Language reintegrates us into the human community. A hardship that finds words to express itself is no longer a radical exclusion and becomes less intolerable. We must speak of failure, abomination, and death, not to drive our readers to despair, but on the contrary, to try to save them from despair. She saw this as helping us communicate with each other through that which is the most solitary in ourselves and by which we are bound the most intimately to one another. De Beauvoir is buried in Montparnasse, not far from Serge Gainsbourg. I should confess, this guy outed me earlier, to having been a music journalist. And I still believe music should dance with life, just as life should dance with music. Sound is all about vibration, molecules bumping into other molecules, disturbing air and displacing the atmosphere. Our ears and brains functioning as musical instruments. A chaotic process, but one which brings us closer together. The percussionist and educator, Evelyn Glennie, a Scot not buried anywhere, she's very much alive, is someone with a mission. She wants to teach the world to listen. I mean, really listen, with your whole body. Glennie started losing her hearing when she was 8 years old. She's worked with everyone from Bjork and Philip Glass to the Royal Shakespeare Company and the London Olympics. I recommend her 2003 TED Talk. She said, "Life begins and ends with listening. Compassion, patience, inclusion, individuality, and cultural awareness are all forms of social listening. To me," she said, "social listening is predominantly what makes us human." I agree. Beauty is in the ear of the beholder. And I'd say it's social listening that shapes the best of our work as speechwriters. Compassion. It's there in our appeal to the emotions. It's what JFK speechwriter Ted Sorensen had in mind when he spoke of brevity, levity, clarity, and charity. Patience. It's a quality our speakers may test at times, but for those of us who work with politicians and their electoral focus, it's Zen and the art of voting cycle maintenance. Inclusion. It's engaging the audience. It's what we do. Individuality. It's ethos, it's integrity, it's character. It's the colour we bring to what could otherwise read like a shopping list. And cultural awareness. It's looking, it's learning, it's welcoming. It's the opposite of othering. In the Red Hand Files, singer and writer Nick Cave's Q&A blog, the greatest living Australian explains his approach. People unburden themselves with a kind of energy where each is elevated by the vitality of the exchange itself, because something is required of each other, some measure of truth, of respect, of regard emerges. That we are heard, each of us, is the thing. The act of listening is perhaps the best we can do for each other. It's a sentiment Simone Weil would surely have validated. What she may have made of Cave's music is another matter. Weil spoke of the need for a regime in which the public freedom of expression is characterized not so much by freedom as by an attentive silence in which the faint and inept cry can make itself heard. Her concern with the response to that cry from any institution, democratic or otherwise, was it can never be capable of the tender and sensitive attention which is needed to understand its meaning. But back to our question, where do we go from here? The three wise monkeys offer us no advice. We can't ask the fourth in case he removes his hands. Johnny Cash, the cowboy watches on inscrutably from that wanted poster. And the crocodilian, well, she smiles her smile like a fanged Mona Lisa. In any case, I contend where do we go from here is more quest than query. And I have my own question. I say my own. Actually, it comes from a song by a musician once married to Cash's daughter, Roseanne, Nick Lowe. The question, open brackets, What's so funny about close brackets, peace, love, and understanding? The lyric is bleak, the melody a thing of beauty, the mood upbeat, the message bittersweet. It may be Lo is playing the part of an ingenue, for he speaks like a child. But the song, it's not a childish thing. And the brackets matter if you listen. I mean, really listen. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you so much for that, Roger. That was actually fantastic. And I think it gives us a lot to think about, like, you know, you could call it the healing power of listening, Rene, couldn't you? The healing power of listening. Has anyone got any questions for Roger?
What happened to the lizard?
The lizard moved out of my toy box, I think. He moved into the shower. He moved on to the door to my mum and dad's room, and then he wasn't seen again. It's a sad story. No happy ending, I'm afraid. Can I just say, in lieu of another question, that the two previous speakers was very taken with what you're saying about truth and also about empathy and community. I kind of very much chimed with me and what I was trying to get across.
One of the things that I was actually going to observe is, having just come back from a similar speech writing conference in America, is a very different nature. Mm. Where over there it was, how can we make this look good? How can we sell it? How can we monetize this? Whereas here we're talking about integrity, empathy, and, you know, values. It's actually quite a stark difference, which I think is another reason why I think this is so. I mean, they're both great in their own respective ways, but I thought it was very, very quite telling of just how lovely and perhaps soppy we are.
Human.
Have a question. Human, you're right.
About listening, do you think people are born good listeners, or do you get better at listening the more you work at listening?
I'd like to say you get better as you work at it, but my family over there might have another view, might offer an alternative to that. Maybe I listen and I pick the phone up and I'm really there in the moment, focused with the caller. I think you can work at it. I think you can work at it. I think you can get better at listening.
So just to check, does everyone know what the Samaritans is? Is that clear?
Because no.
But you get now.
So Samaritans is a helpline. I suppose you could describe it as the suicide helpline. That's not to be misconstrued. You wouldn't phone up for advice on how to end your own life. We wouldn't provide that. It's a long-standing, 70th anniversary is just coming up. It's there for whether you have suicidal thoughts and feelings, to whether you are the other end of that spectrum of depression, anxiety, stress, and you want to speak. I suppose it's part of the talking, and in our case, the listening cure, if you like.
Yeah. Ready?
Why did you join the Samaritans?
Good question. Two reasons. One, I spoke to one of our colleagues who's not here, sadly, Martin Shovel, who's also a speechwriter and a Samaritan. Yeah. And I was interested already. Martin's very passionate and very insightful about that, and I was kind of reassured it would be a good thing to do. The other answer to that is a very middle-class response. Radio 4 in the UK. I was listening to a Radio 4 programme by Michael Rosen, who used to be the Children's Laureate, brilliant, brilliant poet, writer, broadcaster, and he was talking about the language Samaritans use, and it just piqued my interest, Rene, and I thought, maybe I could do that. And it turns out I can.
Good for you.
And then for people who don't know, I think, you know, I was talking to Martin Shovel about this, and said the reason the organisation was set up is because there was, I think, a 13-year-old girl who got her period, didn't understand what it was, and then took her own life. And it's just such a shame to lose life in this way, and if someone just explained to her what's going on. And they want to set up a service where anyone can call and talk to someone for whatever comfort they might need. And I understand this was a very challenging thing to do as a...
No, but it exists in the Netherlands as well, another name, but
yes?
Just a question about Samaritans. Do you meet the other Samaritans?
Yeah, there is a real camaraderie. You are on a shift with at least one, possibly two others, and you support each other, you get to know each other. Between calls, you go, how did that go? You sort of debrief each other. That's part of the support process. Yeah, so there is that sense, very much that sense of community, of tribe. And they're a very, as you can imagine, they're a very empathetic, good listening lot. But that doesn't mean, you know, that they don't have ribald sense of humour and mischief and have a laugh about things and be a little bit subversive even.
I mean, is it common to have the same person calling you repeatedly?
It can happen. It used to be localised, so I'm in the Edinburgh office, we used to get Edinburgh calls. That's become nationalised through the phone system, through the IT, so you can get calls from anywhere. Occasionally you will pick up a call to the same person, particularly if they're a regular caller, it's part of their mental health support, calling some errands. And that's a little bit tricky. Sometimes you have to decide whether you intervene and go, I've spoken to you before, and you know, you have a different kind of conversation, or whether you just allow them to say what they want to say because it's their call. It's kind of a judgment thing.
Kathleen.
That was great, by the way. Thank you very much. And can you talk to the fellow Samaritans, can you talk to each other about the calls you've had?
Yes, you do, because that's, in terms of confidentiality and sensitivity, you have that conversation to support each other, and if you like, to compare notes. How did you handle this? How did you respond? Where did that call go? And that's incredibly beneficial to between you in terms of your learning and your emotional support. So yes, you do, but obviously you don't. If someone's given their name, you wouldn't use their name. You would, you know, respect that confidentiality in that way.
Should
we
go JP and then go
ahead?
JP.
I did say to you yesterday that I'm someone who's had the great luck to talk to Samaritan and to feel a lot better afterwards. And I think it would just be sort of strange to be sitting in the room and not to acknowledge that and to say thank you very much, even though I didn't speak to you. And at the time, I think it's important for people to hear that at the time it was one of the greatest difficulties was to think, oh God, am I one of those people who's in such a bad way that I need to talk to Samaritan?
Yeah.
But it felt so much better afterwards. You know? It needs to be heard that there are people who are talking to Samaritans and who I am and they care about. At a European speech writers conference. So life gets really good afterwards. And I just wanted to say that we would have felt a bit strange if someone had not to say in front of other people what I said.
No, absolutely, JP. I'm also thinking, thank you for that. And I'm also thinking, we were talking about Simone Weil, and I think we shared that sense of she's quite a dense philosopher, writer to get into. We probably spent more time reading books about her rather than the original writing, in all honesty.
We'll get to the question. Thank you so much for sharing that, JP. I'm going to give JP that.
Yeah.
We are going to move on to the next question.
How do you characterise that problem in Scotland right now, since you've been working for them? I mean, like at altitude, how bad is it?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's interesting, because I suppose with my day job, Parliament hat on, parliamentary clerk, I'm thinking this is where policy and reality, you know, kind of collide, if you like. But it's a UK level as well, it's not just Scotland. But I get Scottish calls, and you're right, you're drawn more to those that are local, that are, you recognise the accent. It's grim. Lots and lots of people falling between the cracks in terms of services, mental health, waiting on waiting lists that are never ending, and perhaps they'll never get that counselling or therapy or exactly what it is they need. It's grim, and you kind of realise that you're there to give them that outage and what support you can to give them that platform to talk through their issues. But there are a lot of people out there. There's a lot of loneliness. There's a lot of people who aren't getting the help they need. It's brutal reality.
I think it's also a bit linked into what Honecker's saying about the role of, if we're looking at speakers, not being therapists, but actually having to acknowledge and listen to pain. And then what our role as speechwriters to balance that is something that's really quite complicated. So thank you so much, and a round of applause.